Hi there, I'm James Spencer Boyce, and this is the Total Water Polo Podcast. I'm really pleased that you're with us for this week's episode with a truly sensational player. He plays for one of the most successful clubs on the planet, Pro Recco. He's an integral part of the United States national team, for which he is the captain. And last, but certainly not least, he's considered by the globe's top coaches and players as the very best centre forward in the world. So welcome along to this episode of the Total Water Polo Podcast with Ben Hallock. Firstly though, a nice little discount is awaiting you as usual at wearwaterpolo.com with our podcast discount code PODCAST10, giving you 10% off your next order. You know exactly what to do with that. And also, if you haven't yet, why not give us a review on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, on Amazon or Google or YouTube or wherever. Or maybe just tell a friend about us if you're enjoying the show, which hopefully you are. But enough of that, enough of all the ads. Coming up next, just for you, is my talk with Ben Hallock. Welcome to the Total Water Polo Podcast, Ben Hallock. How you doing?
Great. How you doing?
Yeah, I'm well, thank you. I'm glad we finally got you on the show after a few weeks of me nagging you because you've been traveling. Do you just want to tell us where you've been the last few weeks after Strasbourg?
Yeah, we finished up World League in Strasbourg on the 27th or 8th, I believe. And then I went with a couple of teammates on like a little 6 or 7 day trip. Just took a train from Strasbourg to Paris for two days. Then to London for 2 or 3 days, and then we finished the trip up in Amsterdam for a couple of days. So it was a lot of hectic traveling, but super fun.
That does sound super fun, to be fair. Okay, well, we'll now talk about something that is maybe less interesting than that, but hopefully it'll pick up as the podcast goes on. But do you mind just telling us, the listeners, what perhaps prompted your kind of entry into water polo? How did you get into the game when you were younger?
Yeah, I started playing the game when I was, I think, 10 years old. I was pretty deep into club sports and basketball. You know, in the U.S., I was playing baseball as well. And, you know, every sport, every coach wants you to specialize so early. And so I started, you know, finding myself, you know, going to travel tournaments already for basketball and baseball. And my parents, you know, sat my sister and I down and said, you know, before we specialize completely, before you commit to one sport completely, want you to try something else, and it ended up being either volleyball or water polo. And I grew up in Southern California, you know, in the beach, in the water, swimming, and so the natural one for me to choose was water polo. Believe it or not, I can't jump very high, so volleyball was sort of out of the question. So my sister and I started playing water polo at the same time on the same team, a 12 and under co-ed team, and that was sort of how we got into it. Didn't quite specialize, I would say, until high school. I continued to play basketball, a little bit of lacrosse as well until I was in high school.
Yeah, you could have done basketball instead of water polo. Wow, why didn't you? What was the deciding factor in the end?
I think I was just better at water polo. I don't know if I was, I don't know if basketball was my calling. I loved it, but I was just a little heavy footed. You could hear me coming down the court, coming down the lane from a mile away. Not exactly light footed.
Okay, I won't comment on the heavy footedness, but I guess you're obviously quite talented as a youngster. I guess. Do you remember specifically what point in your water polo development you decided to be a centre forward? You said how you're maybe a bit heavy footed. Is it the traditional story of being bulky and slow at swimming, or is there a little bit more finesse?
No, I mean I was always you know the tallest kid for my age, and I think you know the day that I showed up on the pool deck for my first practice. It was more or less, hey, like, look, it's natural that the biggest kid is going to be a center. And so that was sort of how it started. I remember I changed clubs one time and I went to a first practice with, I think I was 11 years old, and, current national team teammate or former national team teammate, Johnny Hooper, you know, after the first practice, we were both, you know, 10, 11 years old. And he goes, you'd be a really good goalie. And I was like, I don't think so. I was always kind of larger than everyone else, and that was just sort of the natural position. And I also just loved it, the physicality, just sort of the game within a game that the center position is sometimes. So yeah, that was sort of the reason why. I played a little bit all over the place in high school, just because we had other centers as well. But I always felt the most comfortable in the middle.
Okay, that's fair enough. We'll fast forward a little bit, I guess, to the time of where you come to university. Now, it's my understanding you come from a USC family living, as you said, you were brought up in Southern California. Despite that, you, as I can see the t-shirt you're wearing today, you opted for Stanford. Was that a bit awkward when it came to dinner time? Was that a bit of a difficult pitch to your family because of that?
Not exactly. I mean, you know, as I got older in high school, you know, I was, you know, grew up going to USC football games with my dad, you know, going on the field sometimes. And so that was always super special. And that place always had a very special place in my heart. But as I got older, I mean, I was just looking for the best fit for me, the best guys that I got along with in the university. And so, you know, when it came time for me to decide, I wouldn't say there was any real pushback. I think maybe when I was younger, they were like, oh, USC is a great water polo team, he'll go there. But when it came time to decide, it was pretty clear that Stanford was going to be the best place for me, you know, in the pool, out of the pool. So it wasn't exactly awkward, but I'm sure at some point they thought, oh, he'll for sure, maybe he'll go, maybe he won't, but not awkward at all.
Of course, they're now cheering for Cardinal instead of the Trojans. But how much, obviously, when you go to university in America, it's kind of hand in hand, the academic side and the sports performance side. How much do you think your time with Stanford, although it was cut slightly short a little bit, improved you as a player?
It's, you know, going to playing a sport at a university, it pushes you to so many different limits than, you know, it's similar to high school, but it's a whole other level as far as just the responsibility you have. I mean, it's obviously the first time moving away from home. And now you're, you know, you're part of a team, you're choosing what you want to study. You know, it's just such an interesting time in your life and so much responsibility that you have to take on, which I think is just awesome and helped me grow so much as a person, especially being at a place like Stanford. I mean, the academics, the professors that I had, the people that I was just in the classroom with, sometimes a little intimidating. It was more intimidating walking into a classroom than walking into the pool at Stanford. But it was an incredible growth moment period for me. And, you know, being able to practice with some incredible athletes every day, and the facilities are unbelievable. Probably the best facilities that I've, you know, in the world that I've ever been at to this day are the one I got to use between 18 and 22 years old, which is, you know, I wish I still had access to them, but it's something that you have to appreciate in the moment, and something that helped me grow, I think, tremendously as a player.
Yeah, and as you kind of said, playing at Stanford puts you in the shop window, a great university, great history, great players, great facilities. It's inevitable that a decent center forward, Ben Hallock, playing for Stanford, is going to come up on the radar for the national team. Can you kind of describe the environment that exists in America that gets you national team selection? Do you remember when you first popped up on the radar for the national
team? So I was doing a junior national team. There's sort of a large selection process. There's different zones, we call them, within the U.S. You have like a Southern California one. There's actually two or three within Southern California. There's one in Northern California. They have like the mountain one, which is more the middle of the country. They have the East Coast one. And basically you have this process of tryouts when you're 12, 13, 14, you know, all the way up to 18 years old. That basically breaks you down into these zones, puts you in teams, and there's a big, basically national tournament of the best players from each zone. And then the selection process sort of goes on from there. And that's how they select all the junior teams. They want to make sure that they try to look at the entire country, even though most of the athletes are coming from the West Coast, especially now. I don't know how, if you know this, but water polo just got added as a high school sport in Texas, which is huge for the sport in the U.S. I mean, that's adding a 25 million person state. So every single high school in Texas will have water polo now, which is, I mean, not everyone, but most of them, which is a huge deal. So they want to make sure, I think, they look at the entire country, even though most of the team ends up being from California. And so I started that when I was maybe 13 years old. I made my first national team trip when I was 13. I was 13, went to Puerto Rico for Pan American Games on a youth team, which was 17 and under. And then just sort of progressed from there. Again, it's, you know, like any country, water polo is a decently small community. So you just sort of stay in the pipeline. And then when I was 16 or 17 years old, I started practicing with the senior national team. And it just sort of kept on progressing from there, kept on getting better, and eventually started making teams.
Cool. And we're talking about it now, I guess. But you've spoken before, you've been on the record in some articles about how inspiring it was for you to see the team in Beijing take a medal. And obviously, you wanted to emulate that. You broke through, as you said, when you were 17, maybe a bit younger, maybe a bit older, into the US national team, and of course went to Rio as a teenager. You were in the team for World League a few months before, but were you expecting to make the team at the Rio Olympics?
If you had asked me 3-4 months before the Olympics, I would have said no. But then I would say, you know, it's tough when you're in high school. You know, it's not exactly like college. You can't drop out for a quarter, you know, or a semester and go train with the team. It's especially the high school that I went to. It's, you know, you miss more than a couple weeks of school and you can't miss any more or else you're going to, you might, you know, not kicked out, but there might be some repercussions. So, yeah, if you'd have asked me no, but then as, you know, as I finished school and as the summer progressed, I would say I don't know if I surprised myself. I would say I surprised myself a little bit, and probably some other people as well. And by the end, you know, during World League, you know, I believe we got second at that World League in Guangzhou in China. I would say at that point, I probably expected it. But again, I was still extremely unsure. Had never really made a senior team at that point. So definitely a little bit of a surprise. But by the end of it, I would say I expected it of myself a little bit.
And what were you feeling when you were told that you were going to go to Rio?
I would say a sense of relief and also a sense of added pressure. I mean, you just accomplished a life goal, but at the same time, you know, one of the trickiest things is making an Olympic team and then being, you know, accepting that you just, you know, hit a goal of yours, but then that goal doesn't, you know, you have a bigger one in front of you. And obviously Rio didn't go the way we wanted to. So it was a bit of a bittersweet feeling. You accomplish this incredible thing, you know, representing your country, being Olympian, something that's with you forever. And then you have a subpar performance, so it loses a little bitter taste in your mouth. So it was a mix of emotions, I would say.
Yeah, as you've just alluded to, it didn't go entirely the way you wanted. Part of that was circumstantial. You had some unbelievable teams in kind of a group of death, really. Yeah. I think it was called at the time Spain, Croatia, Italy, Montenegro, and even France at that time were still decent. But what did you take away from Rio? What was the bit of learning for you personally coming out of those Olympic Games as a teenager?
You just introduced this whole other level of I would say intensity. I mean, I played World League before and I had been training with the national team against these other teams. And you just saw this new level of physicality, of energy, attention to detail, and yeah, that was I would say that was the biggest thing. Is, you know, when even though you've played against these guys before, the level of the game, the level of their play can always get a lot higher. And you know, that was something going into that, you know, was helpful going into the Tokyo Games and understanding that, not to be surprised by it, but you know, you learn a lot more from when you lose than when you win. So it was just, I mean, I sometimes still pull up some of those games to watch, and I know I was, you know, 6 years ago, I was 18 years old, but you know, sometimes I still pull them up to look at them and you know, sometimes remind myself of what I did right, what I did wrong, more wrong than right.
It's really interesting you say that. Nearly everyone we speak to about their Olympic experience talks about that intensity. There's just something about maybe the magnitude of the tournament, and you kind of touched on it there about how Rio, the experiences there, informed maybe how you approach Tokyo. I'm sure you've had this question put before you, as most who have been double Olympians, but how do you compare the two experiences? They were different experiences, but how would you compare them?
So different. Rio, I was almost in survival mode. Like, I try to think back into Rio. I mean, I was 18 years old, the youngest on the team, just trying to get through every moment. And, you know, I wouldn't say the best organized Olympics. There were some things about it that just didn't go super smooth. I remember, you know, this is the strangest thing. We, in the shower in the village, we'd get in and we'd have to turn on the faucet for the sink in order to get the shower to work. And it was only scalding water, just such hot water. You had to like fill up water bottles and sit there and wait and like shower with these water bottles because the water was, you just couldn't, it didn't touch your skin. And then Tokyo was just, on the contrary, complete opposite, just like the most well-organized thing. But then COVID, and they were just so strict about everything, and it was almost tough to experience anything other than walking back and forth to the pool in your room. But I would say as personally as a player, how I went to it, I mean, I just matured a lot. I was, you know, 5 years older. I played abroad for a year, have been exposed to so many of these players over and over again who we were playing. So I think mentally going into the Tokyo Olympics was just a more of a, I don't know, attack mode in my head, as opposed to Rio, maybe just like finding my way a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. And you said there that you'd spent a year in Europe, and this is what we want to talk about now, your professional career going to Europe. Just before we start and talk about that, to what extent would you say COVID played a part in you moving to Europe? Because as far as I understand it, as I kind of mentioned earlier, maybe you had a year left at Stanford that you had to complete and you were allowed to do it remotely. Is that correct?
Yeah. COVID, I mean, I wouldn't have been in Europe for the 2020-21 season if it wasn't for COVID. And maybe I would have been in Europe for the second half on a different team, but there's no way that I don't think I would have ended up at Recco. So yeah, I my first year at Stanford, I actually redshirted. I didn't play right after the Olympics. And the red shirt, I don't know if you're familiar, people listening are familiar, in the U.S. you can basically not play 1 year, and you can play 4 years, but you can be at school for five, but you can only play for four. And so the red shirt is a year that you don't play. So I redshirted and didn't play my first year. And so my fifth year would have been 2020. That would have been my fourth year of playing. And I had two quarters of school left, maybe. And so about a half year, and COVID happened, and it just didn't look like season, which is usually happens in the fall in the U.S. for men's water polo. It didn't look like it was going to happen. No one knew if it was ever going to happen. So I didn't know if I was going to have it last year, if I was just going to finish school and be done. And I ended up getting a call from Gabby Hernandez, the coach who got hired at Recco in 2020-21 season, just like, hey, what's your deal with school? When are you done? When is this? And I was talking to him and I said, look, I don't know when season's going to happen. I have some school. Everyone's finishing school online. That's an option. And it eventually got to the point where I had to make a decision if I was going to stay around at school and potentially play a fifth year that would happen in the spring, or decide to sign with Recco and go play and basically not play my fourth year of school, which was a very tough decision, because one of the most awesome things about college sports is you only have 4 years. You're not a professional forever. It counts so much, and especially your senior year, your last one with your friends. You know that's the last time you're ever going to put on that Stanford cap. It's not like you can continue to sign these, you know, 5-year contract or whatever it may be. So that was a tough decision. But that's without COVID. I don't think there's any way any of that happens. I wouldn't have left early. No way. I would have stayed and played my last year.
Mm. And you said that Gabby Hernandez, the coach at the time, phoned you up, asked you what you were doing. You obviously ended up going to Recco. Some players and some of the players in your team at the moment have spent years playing professionally in other clubs to work towards getting to a team of the caliber of Recco. That was your first club, right in at the deep end. Doesn't happen very often. What was your first reaction when you arrived in Recco, your first training session?
Yeah, I mean, I was unbelievably fortunate that, you know, I don't know how those talks went with at Recco of like, hey, who's this kid? Are we calling him? They actually came to Stanford the year before for some training, for like a little U.S. trip, and we played against them. But I never quite asked or knew how those conversations went with them. Obviously, super grateful that they were willing to give me a chance. And I guess when I arrived, it was, you know, for myself and how I looked at it, I was sort of the impression that I probably had to prove myself a little bit, even though I'd been playing international water polo. Everyone expected, hey, who's this guy? Who can he compete at this level? We really don't know. So I would say that was sort of my mindset going into it. And, you know, right when I arrived there, it was after COVID. I wasn't in the pool for months at a time. Showed up, had to quarantine because I was coming from the US for 2 weeks, and the team had been training for about a month. And I was just in a bit of survival mode for the first couple of weeks. Just trying to not embarrass myself and get through it. But, I got my body back after COVID, just started being a lot more comfortable in the water with all the great players that are there, that were there and that were on that team and are still there. And it was just, you know, going from having to prove myself to contributing and being a member of the team, I would say.
Yeah, definitely surviving, as you've kept saying, to thriving. Just one thing you mentioned there about proving yourself. Do you think, as an American, maybe if you want to class it as like an Anglophobe or an English speaker, as an American, Kiwi, Aussie, some of the clubs in Europe can be quite snobby. It can sometimes be a bit of a closed shop. American players, no offense, are often kind of seen as to be robotic, maybe a bit of a soft touch, naive. I'm not slagging you off in front of your face. For sure. There is a question. Do you agree with, not necessarily that notion, but do you agree that that perception exists? And were you ever made to feel like that?
I would say I was never made to feel like that. I would say that's definitely, European clubs have a European bias, naturally. And anytime you have a non-European, whether it's an American, Aussie, Canadian, whatever it may be, I think it's one thing if you're an established player and you've been around a lot, but when you're coming as a foreigner for the first time, they expect a lot of foreigners. They expect them to be some of the best players on the team, whatever club you're going to. And a lot of the times, you do well, it's, fantastic. You don't do well, sometimes it's kind of on your shoulders, and the next year you're probably onto the next team, which what you've seen a lot with non-European players. I would say I did experience that stereotype a little bit when I arrived. I wouldn't say with Recco, but you can just see it, when we were playing other foreigners, how they would talk about maybe a non-European foreigner on another team, like, hey, we can take advantage of him. He's not used to this water polo and whatnot. And I would say, yes, I would say it exists. I wouldn't say it's as bad as maybe people think they are, because when you play, there's still a lot of good players. You play at the Olympics, you play at the World League. It's not like all the non-European teams are getting, last place. And, we've still been able to beat some teams and, show them that potentially that, teams outside of Europe can still be really good and produce good players. So, yeah.
They might think about targeting you and taking advantage, but it became pretty clear you settled in really well. And the last two seasons have been there's been some absolutely fantastic water polo from you at centre. You're now considered to be the best centre forward in the world. When you hear things like this, does it give you a bit of confidence? Not arrogance, but does it give you a bit of swagger in the pool when you know that you are one of the best, world-class performer in your position?
I would say, yeah, it would maybe give me some confidence. I would also say it just gives me a lot of energy or drive just to potentially, attempt to live up to it. Or, every day when you get in the pool, you're only as good as your next game or your last game. And so, every time you jump in the pool, you have the ability to, keep a title like that or lose a title like that. So I wouldn't say it's something I really think about. Every time I jump in the pool, I'm just trying to dominate that game against, who I'm playing and, help my team win. But I would say, it's not something that I hear very often. I think, I'm trying to help my team win no matter what and be the best player that I can be. If that ends up being, one of the best center forwards in the world, it ends up being that. And so I would say just it definitely motivates me just because I'm trying to be the best version of myself. So that's what I'll say. Definitely motivates for sure.
Yeah. I would like to talk more about Recco actually. And, I think a good place to start, here is a question from Nicholas Prosciutti. Normally we deal with the questions in part two. I'm breaking with format totally here. It's not that bad, but, he asked, who taught you Italian? also, there's a question here from the Spark Plug One, who kind of on a similar note asks, how do you play and practice on a team that speaks a different language? Did Nicholas teach you Italian, or did someone else teach you Italian?
I would say Nicholas played a big role in teaching me Italian.
What was the first phrase, do you think, or can you not repeat it on the podcast?
No, yeah, phrases from Nicholas, I don't think I can say on a podcast. Because I'm sure some people listening might speak Italian as well. But I mean, one thing I loved about with Nicholas is, right when you come, it's really hard because people want to also practice their English with you. Just because, not oftentimes do they have a perfect English speaker on the team. And one thing I always appreciate about Nick was he always just wanted to speak Italian. Even if I had no idea what he was saying, he would always just, try to describe it in a different way. And so, he's a very good friend of mine. obviously going to play with him for a few more years, and having him, you know, speak Italian to me in the first year, of course, it was a little rough. You know, probably the first 5-6 months, I was just looking at him with a blank stare. But as I studied more on my own, you know, and as the year progressed and was able to, you know, hear more Italian, I would say, you know, learned a lot more. And at this point, you know, I'll never say I'm fluent, but, you know, socially I'm a lot better, you know, talk about anything I want really with Nick or any of the other guys. So I would say, yeah.
Cool.
But Nicholas, I'll give Nick the credit there.
Yeah, fine. It seems like he was fishing for that. So yeah. He's got it. But for some reason, my show notes are kind of a bit jumbled, but just going back to Pro Record and the experience that you have, obviously a top club. No, that's a gross understatement. It's considered maybe the Harlem Globetrotters equivalent of water polo, normally with the world's 13 best players, particularly when it comes to European competitions. But what would you say about the environment in Recco? You touched on Stanford, the facilities, the culture, great. Would you say that is replicated in Recco? For example, does Recco have the 13 hardest working players? Or are they just naturally talented? Or what's the culture like?
I can only speak about the record that I've been there for the last 2 years. And I would say, you know, both years, the group of guys that we've had has just been incredible. How tight-knit they are. You know, the egos has been pretty much non-existent, which I think has been incredible. And just like the industriousness of everyone, I guess, if you want to say, just how willing to work everyone is. Nobody's complaining. Whatever the coach is pretty much asking is what we're going to do. And I would say, I mean, the pool in Recco is, you know, I would say the pool at Stanford is probably nicer, but I would take the pool probably at Recco any day, just with the view next to the ocean. It's probably the most, you know, most beautiful pool that I have been at and have a privilege to be there for a few more years. And so I would say, you know, the facilities are decently replicated. I think there's some things that, you know, we're lucky in the U.S. with the college system that we have football, and basically they build all the facilities, you know, the weight rooms for football, and all the other sports just get to use them. It'd be like us, you know, getting to use, you know, Inter Milan's weight room and their facilities pretty much is the equivalent, is how I would say it, or being able to, you know, if you live in Liverpool, use their facilities. So I think it's just a strange thing at university in the U.S., but the facilities are great. The pool is beautiful. I can't complain whatsoever, and the guys have been nothing but fantastic.
Mm. And your team has been fantastic when it's come to the trophies, Champions Leagues, back-to-back Italian Leagues, Italian Cups. You kind of think it's quite difficult for things to get better from here on. But what is the biggest challenge, do you think, for Recco, playing for Recco? Does the team have any insecurities? Do the players themselves, they don't play like it, do they have any vulnerabilities as a squad, and are you aware of them?
I would say the hardest part of, you know, and I don't know if you want to say the hardest part, it's also going to be the best part if you relish it, is just the expectation. I mean, maybe every club goes into every year saying, hey, we want to win everything, but it's a truly like expectation from the rest of the water polo world of Recco. Like if Recco, or it's like the Yankees, or it's, you know, if they lose, then it's a big deal. If they win, it's like, okay, maybe that was expected, which is a lot different than a lot of other teams. It's, you know, if they win, it's a huge success. And obviously for us, winning is a massive success. I'm not saying that it's just a average year or whatever. But I would just talk about maybe the expectation from the water polo community. And so I would say managing those expectations and sort of relishing it and being able to enjoy it and enjoy the work and enjoy the games, even when the pressure's there, is probably a special trait that, you know, a lot of the players there have gotten used to. And it's something that, you know, I've had to get used to, and it's something that I've been able to enjoy, being, you know, being the bad guy a little bit. You can sort of relish in that.
Yeah. Maurizio loves winning the Champions League, and there's no doubt about that. And obviously you've spoken a little bit about the coach. Your coach this year is Sandro Sukno. Everyone's well versed in the story surrounding him. But what's it like to be coached by Sandro? I mean, did you ever play against him or watch him?
I played against him. He probably doesn't remember. I played against him in the summer of 2015 when I was like my first, just like some training in Croatia, and then played against him at the Olympics as well. So I played against him in probably two or three games and some practices. But that was really my only exposure to him. And then until he was my coach. But I mean, playing against him, it was, I remember we were going to the game and our first game in Rio, we were playing Croatia and the game plan that we had laid out for him was pretty hectic and intricate. Just all the details and things we'd been planning for quite some time. We ended up losing that game by a couple. I think the only goal he scored was a 5 meter. So I guess we accomplished that, but, and then now having him as coach, I mean, it's pretty awesome. I'm a big fan of the way he goes about his business and the way he coaches, and you know, how professional it is. I think he's good at having a big picture mindset for the season, as well as, being able to look at, you know, the day-to-day practice and the grind and understanding what players need, or, you know, if we need to do more work, less work, whatever it may be. So I had nothing but good experiences with him so far.
Yeah. I mean, it's a stupid thing to say really, but when you're a good player, obviously it gives you credibility to go into a role like, being a head coach. And that's compounded, especially when some of the players he's coaching are older than him, or maybe played against him and maybe thought they got the better of him. But anyway, moving on, we'll ask this one. We ask this to nearly every American we ever come across on the podcast and in interviews. So we'll have your hot take as well. Would you like to give your analysis, maybe describe the biggest difference between the pro leagues in Europe versus the collegiate system in the United States? There was a question in part two. I didn't think we'd have time for it, but it kind of went along the lines of what can the United States do to create a similar professional league, or, you know, what are the flaws in the collegiate system that can bring it in line with the professional league? Have you got any, it's a difficult question to ask and it's complicated, but have you got any thoughts on this kind of thing?
Yeah, I've thought about this. I've thought about the two systems so much. And I've thought about it in terms of like Olympic sports. I mean, you would have had to think if there was a better system, then there would be like a gross difference in performance at like Olympic sports or something. And I would say, this is such a tough one. I think there's just so many benefits to both sides of it. I mean, obviously look at the pro system, and once you turn, you know, 17, 18, you're then thrust into playing against players who are, you know, in their 20s and their 30s, which, you know, there's a lot of studies that have shown that playing against older players is the biggest, at a young age, is like the biggest indicator of how good you're going to be. And it's always good to play against older players. And I'd say that's the one, I guess, limiting factor of playing polo in the US or maybe another team sport, is you're going to be playing against kids up to 22 years old. So not exactly playing against people who are at their physical peak yet, even though it's still a high level of water polo, and you can still get a lot better, and it's an unbelievably competitive environment. I would say, but then you also look at the European system, and I mean, it's the education that you can get, you know, playing water polo in the US is also pretty invaluable. So I think there's, you know, if you look at purely just sports, if you want to maximize how good you are at a sport, I would say, yeah, throw the college out the window and just immediately start playing. But, you know, I'm fortunate and I think, and super lucky, and I think it's, you know, a great thing to be able to go to school as well and get a degree. Things that the US could do to potentially create a league, I know it's been tried a couple times. I don't have the answer to that. If I had the answer to that, I'd probably be working on it right now. But, you know, as far as right now, we just don't have the sponsors, there's just not, you know, the athletic clubs that are in Europe that basically pay for some of these teams, or the sponsors. It's just, there's no real interest, I think, for a lot of the teams in the US, and there's no other leagues that exactly work like that in the US. Most of the leagues that are popular and sustainable are, you know, huge sports that make a lot of money. And unfortunately, water polo is not there right now. I hope it will be one day. But I don't have the answer for what we can do is in terms of making a league.
That's fair enough. There was a lot of pressure put on you to answer a huge challenge. But anyway, we'll talk about going forward, maybe this season and beyond. Another season in Recco for you. Yeah.
Yep.
What targets are you setting? What targets are the club setting? What are your teammates setting? Is it difficult to set goals after you've achieved, presumably, some of the goals, the targets to win the Champions League, the Cups? Is it hard to set goals after you've kind of achieved them?
I don't think it's difficult to set the goals. I think it's then difficult to then follow up on them and, you know, get back to the day-to-day grind and understanding the work that's needed to be done to get back to where you want to be. So, I mean, if I had to give you the goals, it would be win all four trophies this year, you know, the Italian Cup, Italian Championship, the Super Cup, and the Champions League, just like it was last year. But then I think, you know, it's easy to say that, you know, talk is cheap, but I think then following up and, you know, showing up to the pool when we will, in a bit this summer, and, you know, putting in the work and not feeling entitled to anything because you had a good season the year before, I think, is the most important thing. And, you know, I can probably assure you that Sandra will take care of most of that.
Yeah, I bet. And with regards to the national team, I mean, further afield, we're 2 years out, just under 2 years out from Paris. There's a really positive vibe to the American team at the moment. Great performances at times in Budapest. You were impressed massively at the World League before you went off interrailing around Europe. Some great young players off the top of my head. Adrian in goal. Chase is certainly one for the future. Hannes, Alex and Max have been around for a while. Is this the core of the team? Is this the start of something potentially quite big for the US national team heading into Paris? And then, of course, after Los Angeles, you said you were inspired by a 2008 silver medal. Could you be taking a medal home yourself, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think the most important thing is keeping a group of guys around, you know, potentially past Paris is probably the most important aspect of that. And that's not saying that, you know, we won't do well in Paris. I think we will. You know, we have our own goals for that. But, you know, obviously the performances this summer, you know, at times were great. I think there's still just one, you know, speed bump that we need to get over as far as winning a crossover game in one of the Olympic or World Championship tournaments. We've shown that we've always done pretty well at World League. Funny enough, you know, since I've joined the national team since I was 18, I've gotten second three times, fourth once, and then seventh once. And so I don't know if that's, you know, Americans are good at swimming in 6 games, 6 days. Maybe that's the thing. I don't know what it is. Maybe we should win all the tournaments like that. But I would say we do have a good group of guys. You know, this, you know, the list, you know, we have, you know, so many other good players as well that, you know, played really well this year. And a lot of guys who are up and coming can push the way onto the team. Some guys coming back from Tokyo who took a break this last year. So we should have a really good team, a very competitive team to make. And it should be a lot of fun going forward. And I'm really excited about the group for sure.
Yeah, me too. And we look forward to seeing what you can produce and what the team can produce genuinely. We're going to head for a break now and we'll be back with some questions. And there'll be quite a few, I think, after this short break. Welcome back to part two of the Total Water Polo podcast. We are with Ben Hallock today, and this is the part, Ben, the second part of the episode where we put people's questions that they've sent in on social media to you, and hopefully you answer them to the best of your ability. Before we do that, we often ask our own question. We ask our guests to give their total seven, their ultimate team of players, seven players you can have played with them, against them, they might be retired, or just people that you look up to. Seven players, please, if you don't mind.
Okay. So seven players. I'll just do a full team of my left side. I'll put Sukno and left side, I'll put, okay, I'll start with Sukno. At center, I'm going to put Boris Slokovic. He's probably my idol. In goal, I'll put probably Šefik. Never played against him, but I always saw him in videos, and it was just the most scariest man I've ever seen in goal. Right side, I'll probably put Filipović, and who's another player I watched a lot when I was younger? Akish, just when I was younger, Gurgly Kish. Growing up, at defender, Ivovich, like, you know, captain of the team, teammate, most unbelievable motor, work ethic, human being I've ever been around. And I'm missing one player left side. Who should I go for the other left side spot? I'll throw my boy Aaron in there. I'll throw Younger in there.
There we go. I knew it. Yeah. You mentioned you're obviously a centre forward. You mentioned the centre back there, Ivovich. We've spoken to a few of his teammates on the podcast before. They've spoken about his work ethic as being one thing. But as a centre forward, do you hate it when he comes and marks you? Is he the hardest person, do you think, that you've ever played against? Obviously, I'm not sure. Maybe you've played against him a few times for the States, but
yeah, I mean, I've played against him in you know, international games for sure a couple times, and he doesn't play as much defender with the national team just because I think he's too valuable. You have to keep him in games, and how the game was being ref the last few years. Even if he's stronger than everyone else, he can just be excluded for no reason. But in practice, you know, not every day, but more or less, I play against him, and it's a fight for survival. It's, you know, you have to go into it, you know, you gotta get yourself more psyched than you are for the biggest game you've ever played in your life because of how strong he is and the intensity that he's going to bring to everything. Just the physical freak he is, just how strong he is. And you just look at him and he's just so solidly built in his legs and his upper body and his core. So yeah, whenever you play against him, you have to be, you know, you can't be half there thinking about something else or not physically present. Or else you're just going to get embarrassed, which I think has been, you know, a good learning experience for me coming in, you know, my first year at Recco, 22 years old, and he's, you know, 34 and just a grown man. So I think that was a lot of good growing moments for me in practice playing against him.
I bet. And kind of linked to that, we've got a few questions, loads of people sent in questions like this, _Carlo.Muzi_ _Slyne_Mativ_WaterPolo. There's loads. I could mention them all. Tips for centre forwards. What advice would you give? Maybe, you know, there's hundreds of things we could speak for hours about it, but what maybe one thing would you give our listeners?
One thing I would give is study film of other centers, watch other centers, because when you play water polo, just like in any sport, you know, you're going to have the things that you're comfortable with. And maybe you're not going to think about how, you know, shooting a ball a different way or doing a different kind of shot or a different kind of movement. But I would say, don't be afraid to watch other centers and be willing to, you know, take things from other people. You know, no one says you can't do that. No one says you can't watch someone that you're playing against and be like, he does a really good job at that. I can steal that and put that in my game. And then I'll say one more thing, and I'll say swimming. I would say don't be afraid of, I'd say a lot of centers is a predisposition of being, you know, pretty slow, you know, coming in last in the swim sets. And that's just, I would say, don't be afraid to push yourself in the swim sets and be faster. And I think it's a huge asset when you have a center that isn't, you know, the slowest person in the pool.
You're basically telling people not to be lazy.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's fine. That's fair enough. I think that's why most centers actually become centers. But and that actually link to that all day. TK16 on Instagram said, "What centers did you look up to?" I think you maybe mentioned Boris in your total seven, but you've said there about watching videos of centers. What centers did you watch videos of, perhaps?
Yeah, I used to have a coach when I was in age group water polo, and he used to print out these CDs for me of, you know, international. I remember one of them was highlights from the 2011 World Championship Games in Shanghai, and it was like this. I think the clips, the videos on YouTube as well. But he used to just give me these discs of these players, and I remember, I mean, on that, you know, 2011, it was, you know, Slokovic was still playing, Pietlovic was there, Ryan Bailey, the American center, you know, also an incredible player. And I would say those three are probably the ones that I watched the most. I mean, for me, it was always, for some reason, just like whenever I watched videos of Slokovic, it was just like, looked at it and I was like, that's just like the most fluid, incredible, athletic person I've seen playing center. And so that was just someone that I always tried to, I watched him live once at a game in 2000, maybe it was 2009 or 10 in the US. They came and played. And so that was the only time I got to see him live, but I've always just tried to watch, you know, of course he retired after the London Olympics and watched a lot of those games. So I would say that's something, it's the person that I've watched the most. And the person that I could probably relate to the most as far as body type, you know, looking at someone like Pjanic, you know, most unbelievable center, one of the greatest of all times. But I just think we're a little different body types. He's just a little more compact and maybe more explosive. So not that I can't take anything from him, but just I'd say just a little slightly different of a style.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Brenda Villa has got in contact, and she kind of, following on from maybe what you've said, she asked, who was your favorite water polo player growing up?
I would say growing up, I mean, I grew up watching the national team when I was younger, so I'd say probably watching Tony was pretty awesome, winning that silver medal. I had only been playing water polo for a year and a half, maybe 2 years, and when they, you know, maybe a little less, maybe a year in 2008. And so, you know, being able to watch him and then, you know, growing, you know, getting older, getting more into the sport, watching some more national team games live, and then being able to play with him, that was probably, you know, the person that I looked up to the most. I would say I was a big fan of Koshosh growing up too. Never got to see him play live, but, you know, watched the 2004 game, the end of it, where he, I think, had, a goal, an assist, and then, you know, scored the 5 meter to win the game. I don't exactly remember what it was, but, you know, just I would say, but first probably Tony, just because he was an American. That was a super, super cool thing to watch them succeed, and how incredible players he was. But then I would say someone like Koshas was up there as well, even though we played totally different positions, and it's pretty, at terms of what I do now, it's pretty unrelatable. But
no, that's fair enough. They're decent role models, to be sure. Okay, there's some questions here about college in America. They're slightly different, but they're both worth mentioning maybe together. Camden_Perk says, did you ever think you weren't good enough for college water polo? And Sergio Samada Jr., also on Instagram, says, what is a good way to get noticed by colleges and universities? So it's both about college. Did you ever think that you weren't good enough? Did you ever not believe in yourself? And secondly, what is a good way or the best way to get noticed by those clubs?
Yeah, I think everyone has moments of, am I good enough in all aspects, whether it's college, whether it's maybe the national team. Did I have a moment like that? Maybe when I was, you know, when I was younger, when I was growing up, and maybe had a game or an experience against a college team when I was, you know, 13, 14 years old. And maybe I thought, hey, can I do this? I think, you know, self-belief is it's a hard currency to come by, but I think it's just something that you need to stick with yourself. Even if you don't see the results in the moment, it's something that you need to stick with. And that's, you know, if no one else believes in you, you can believe in yourself, and that's really all you need. And as far as getting contact with coaches, I would say recruiting nowadays might operate a little differently with all of the highlight videos and the resources that you can make. I mean, I know in the US we use something called Huddle. I don't know if that's exactly huge in Europe. It's basically a video. It's like basically a sourcing program to college coaches in the country where you can upload your clips, highlight clips of different games and defenses and, you know, you scoring goals or whatever to contact with coaches. And again, it's a pretty small community. So, you know, just playing at Junior Olympics in the US is a huge one. Even if you're a foreigner, I would say clubs in the U.S. love having a foreigner come over for, you know, a month during season, and playing a Junior Olympics. I think there's a Hungarian guy, Bigvari. He came over and played. I know he didn't go to school, but it's just like players can come over and play, and there's been different ones. And so I would say, you know, getting video of yourself out to coaches is a huge one, especially if you're from Europe. Is super important because the college coaches won't see you in tournaments throughout the year in the US. And if you're from the US, I would say just going to as many tournaments as you can, getting as much face time as possible, and just introducing yourself as well. Don't be afraid to walk up to a coach, no matter who he is, and introduce yourself and say, you know, who you play for, and, you know, can I have your email? Can I send you some videos of myself? I would just say you have to be a little bit of a salesman at some point.
Yeah. Great advice. Believe in yourself. Send videos and try and compete at the Junior Olympics, which is, of course, I think is a great thing that America do really well. Which one's next? Okay, we have a question here. We have two, actually, quite greedy, two questions, but we'll ask them both because they're both quite good, from Morgan Kirkpatrick. The first one is, what is your best tip for performing at your best? What do you do, Ben, before you play? What do you do when you train? Is there anything you think? Is there any kind of process you go through before a game or for training that you think really helps you achieve high performance?
That's my sister. So thank you, Morgan, for that question. I would say for me, the biggest thing, I mean, sports psychology, you know, when I've talked with them and they've talked to teams, is you talk about this bell curve and sort of the physical, they call it the physical and emotional excitement curve, and you want to be sort of right in the sweet spot. And for me, it's always been making sure I'm high enough up on that I'm pumped up enough. For me, it's never been a problem that I've been, too ready to go. So I would say before practices and before games, it's about getting myself in a, I wouldn't say angry mindset, but just a sort of attack mode mindset that I'm going to, you know, be the person with the most energy in the pool. And so that's for me. And then also, I would say preparation. If you study really hard for a test, you know, there's going to be no reason being nervous going into it. And the same is for water polo. And I would say that's something that we do a lot more in the States than I think that happens in Europe, is scouting and preparation. And, you know, being able to look at videos of an entire team and look at the shot clips of every single player, and have an idea in your head, even if you don't play them super often, that, hey, they go under the arm a lot of the time or over the head, or they like this certain move, and being able to have tangible video to watch before games. And I think preparation is, you know, in all things, you know, if you're prepared, you know, you're going to be more confident going in. You're not going to be as nervous because you have an idea of what's going to be coming. So I'd say preparation, and then making sure that I'm high enough on that bell curve, if you want to say.
Yeah. Okay. That's fine. The second question there is, what are you most excited about for the Paris Olympics? All being well, you'll be there. So what's the most exciting bit, you think?
I would say I'm looking forward to a normal Olympic experience. Hopefully COVID is, no longer a factor there. I mean, I know in Rio there was the Zika, and it was just a strange, both Olympics have been a little bit of a strange experience with something hanging over it. I'd say, yeah, looking forward to having a completely normal Olympic experience, and also just to the chance and the opportunity and the honor to compete for the U.S. at the Olympics again, be able to walk during opening ceremonies and, see the flag and see the crowd and just feel that emotion of representing your country at the highest stage again. And also just, I mean, Paris should be unbelievable. It's one of my favorite cities in the world. I remember one of my teammates was talking, I guess they're doing the opening ceremonies. All the teams are going to be in boats on the river, going back. I just think it'll be such a special thing. And just feeling that emotion of jumping in the pool, and being able to play for your flag.
Yeah. Yes, it sounds awesome, especially that boat thing.
Yeah,
the opening ceremony, I saw that the other day. Should be good. Okay, we'll ask this question from Grisotto 3. What is the biggest difference between United States national team training and pro reco practice? Obviously, it's a bit of a complicated question, but is there one thing that you noticed? Not necessarily talking about the standard of training, but obviously the national team meets every so often. You're at a club 9 months a year. What's the big difference in the sessions?
When you join a club team, like you said, you have 9 months. You have a lot of time to physically prepare. I wouldn't say there's a huge rush to just, you know, kill yourself and get in shape in a matter of weeks, or maybe if you have 1 month, if you're lucky, before a tournament. And so I would say when you join the national team, it's a little bit more, just a little more time pressure to get into shape. And maybe the hours are a little bit longer, a lot longer potentially, because you're so condensed into two and a half months. And, you know, I always join the last 2 years. I joined the team basically 2 weeks before our first tournament. So for 4 World Championships, I was with the team for maybe 12 days, 12, 13 days. So there's just a lot more time pressure. So you're putting in a lot more hours, I would say. It's just too different. You know, there's not a huge concern of like long-term, you know, making sure that you're healthy for the next 6 months. It's like, hey, we got 2.5 months, we got this tournament, and we got to play it. You got to, you know, if you have a problem, you got to, you know, swallow it and continue. But I would say that the standard is the same. I mean, we, you know, obviously we have a European coach, but got a lot of hard workers on the team here in the States, and guys who push themselves and push everyone else as well.
Yeah. And just linked to that, waterball_6x5 says, what's your favorite thing being coached by Dejan? Is there anything you like or don't like, considering your selection for the next tournament? So be careful what you say.
No. One of my favorite things about Dejan is he trusts his players. He trusts his players a lot. He trusts your input. If you have a gut feeling about something that you want to do, he's never going to tell you not to take a shot. He's going to tell you, I'll never tell you not to shoot, but you know, if you shoot, you got to score. It's sort of his, his mentality. And it's just sort of the, believe in yourself. And, and he, I would say he's believed in me more than I've had, maybe any other coaches put their trust in me at a very young age. And that's something I'm super, super grateful and thankful for. I would just say just the belief that he puts in his players, and the attitude that you can approach into a game, when you know that your head coach believes in you like that, and the rest of your players believe in you yourself, it's easy to believe in yourself at that point.
And the same person asks, which one of your teammates has had the worst tattoo? Bit of a random one, but you've had a lot of teammates. Many of them have tattoos. Who's got the worst?
Oh, man. Let me think about all the tattoos right now. I can't they're all my good friends. I can't throw any of them under the bus. I'll say Hannes has a couple good ones. He's got the rings. He's got the Maori tattoo because of his family. Johnny. Johnny has some ones. I don't quite understand maybe all of Johnny's, so maybe I'll say his, Johnny Hooper. He got the rings. He has something on his ankle. Yeah, I'll say Johnny, but that being said, I don't think it's bad at all. I just maybe sometimes I haven't gotten the full story on maybe all of them.
Well, I asked who the worst was, and you've come up with Johnny. Now people are furiously searching for what tattoos he's got to see if you've got it right. Okay, that's fair enough. Those two can battle it out for the tattoos. We've got one last question, I guess, but it kind of ties into a broader question. I hope I'm saying the name right. It's never stopped me before from saying it wrong, but Morio Saito asks, how is the golf going? Are you any good at golf? Now, are you any good at golf?
I don't know if I'm good at golf. I like to play golf. I played my first 18 since I've been home yesterday, shot in 86. And that was with two doubles and one triple. So three blow up holes. I shot an 86, which, I mean, first, I don't know. I'm happy with that for my first one back. Hopefully, as I'm here for a couple more weeks, I can improve on that. But I do enjoy playing. I don't know.
You'll be off scratch soon.
No, I don't know about scratch. I broke 80 once, and if I can break 80, not semi consistently, once in a while, that'll keep me happy. But Morio, I went to high school with Morio, played water polo with him, played golf with him a couple times. Yeah.
And it kind of ties in, as I said, to a broader question. What do you do when you're not playing water polo? So you like to go to the driving range, you like to play a few 18 holes. What other things do you like doing?
So that's, I would say when I'm home, that's my main activity. Something to take my mind off of water polo completely. Just kind of go and solve this new, this new problem of golf, the most frustrating thing ever, but also pretty fun. It's a little harder when I'm in Italy. There's a golf course that I've played a few times near Recco, but it's just kind of hard to, I don't have my own clubs there.
You're blaming your tools.
Yeah. Recently I've tried to get into a bit of photography a little bit. I have a teammate who's always been sort of into it. And so I think I've gotten into that a little bit more. And then I would say the last couple of years, learning Italian has taken up most of my time. I was never someone who excelled in school at learning a language. And that was something that's taken up most of my time. I would say one of the great things about playing abroad is, I mean, we, have double days 4 or 5 times a week. So I don't say there's a ton of free time, but, you can for sure find new hobbies. And getting out of school, I just found myself, bought a Kindle, just read. I read a ton, find things that interest me. But I would say Italian's taking up most of my time. And I'm looking forward to improve on that and getting to a point where I can, say I'm fluent, which would be awesome. But not there yet. But I think that's my main focus.
Yeah, good. We'll keep it up, and we'll be looking forward to hearing you speaking some Italian next time you come on the podcast. Thank you, everyone, who sent a question in. And, of course, thank you, Ben, for joining us. Take care, and hopefully we will see you next season in the Champions League.
Awesome. Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Well, I never get tired of talking to the best players in the game, and Ben is certainly that. So many things to take away from today. Not least that Ben loves his golf, and that's where he's off to now. Just before we finish this call, he said he was going to play a bit of golf, so hopefully he enjoys that, and hopefully you enjoyed this podcast. And if you did, why don't you check out some of our other episodes we've had. We've spoken to Maddie Musselman and Felipe Perone in the first few episodes, both former Total Player Award winners. If you prefer the tactical side of the game, we've had top coaches such as Hungary's Golden Generation head coach Denis Kameni, or the current Jurg Dubrovnik head coach Jeko Kobuska. Both featured with us really well. Alternatively, you might be interested in listening to the voice of new talent, fresh talent, upcoming players like Simone van der Kratz, Thomas Vernu, or Dusan Matkovic. If you follow the women's game, we've had Maggie Steffens, Becca Parks. They both joined us. Been really, really good chats. Or if you love Champions League, for example, maybe listen to Aaron Younger, Konstantinos Giannoudounis, or Cosmin Radu. Those episodes might just be for you. We have the biggest names in world water polo on the show, ready to share their stories with you, and we hope that we have enough here to keep you inspired and connected to our beautiful sport. Thanks again for tuning in. I'm James Spencer Boyce, and we'll see you next time on the Total Water Polo Podcast.